You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, December 8th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Suki Hawley, the director, producer, editor of the documentary Battle for Brooklyn, an incredibly timely film, just a great example of the 1%, the rich having just a little bit more democracy than the rest of us do. We'll be talking to her about her film, the issues, the ongoing issues involved in it. It's an amazing, it's a great film, an amazing story. Didn't necessarily work out so well in the end, but we will talk to her about that. Also, another story which also didn't work out so well in the end. The FDA approves the Plan B contraceptive pill, the emergency day after pill, as it's known, to be sold over the counter. And then, in an unprecedented move, the head of Health and Human Services quashes that decision. Politics once again trumping science. To their credit, though, the Obama administration makes a very strong announcement internationally about gay rights. We will get to that. And folks, it is really looking like Newt Gingrich. Not only is he going to be the standard bearer of the anybody but Mitt contingency in the Republican Party, it looks like he might very well win the primary. I don't know what to say about that. Now, I've actually got plenty to say about it, but we will save that for later in the program. Just a couple of house cleaning notes. We will be launching, if all goes well, the new majority.fm site Friday morning. You're going to want to check this out, folks. It is so awesome. It's not to be believed. And let me tell you something. Kyle has been putting this together. He has been, he's not using any image files. He's using this all as he's creating this all CSS. I have no idea what that means, but I know that it's impressive. So make sure you check that out. Also, ladies and gentlemen, it is with deep regret that I say that the Sinclair, the trusty 17-inch MacBook Pro donated to us by the Sinclair's owner, Sinclair himself, I think almost now, probably a year ago, he sent it to us. We turned it on this morning, and we have video, which we should probably post after the show, of Matt backing away from the computer thinking that it's going to explode. Now it seems to be running fine now, but I think the Sinclair is on its last legs. If you have lying around your house an old Mac Mini or MacBook Pro that is Intel-based. So you can't use a non-Intel-based computer based upon the uses that we use it for. But if it's Intel-based, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com, and we will take it off your hands in anticipation of the Sinclair dying. It's sad, but the Sinclair basically carried the show on its shoulders. It's very broad shoulders, incidentally, for the past 11 months, and we could be at its end. Monday on this program, David Grable will be with us, and tomorrow, of course, Cliff Schechter. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I will be talking to the director, producer, and editor of Battle for Brooklyn. And in the meantime, here is a trailer from that film. We'll be right back after this.
The New Jersey Nets may soon be the Brooklyn Nets. Bruce Ratner
says he will move the Nets into a proposed arena complex right in the heart of Brooklyn. There are those who are raising serious objections about the loss of homes and businesses.
My building is right about here under the arena.
I moved into a neighborhood because I wanted to live in it for a long time, perhaps raise a family in. If you can't fight for your community and your home and your neighbors, you're really probably not going to fight for anything.
We are going to get the Nets to Brooklyn. If it's the last thing I do.
It's somewhat of a David versus Goliath situation, but David wins sometimes.
Their homes will be taken by force and abusive eminent domain.
Where can I go now? Where?
You should stay home.
Well, we don't want us there. We don't want us there.
This is Brooklyn's future. We deserve it. It's our time.
We're both doing this work. We're both obsessed with this.
All of that brings more money into Brooklyn, more pride into Brooklyn, and more employment into Brooklyn.
That's why this fight gets ugly at times, because you have a community at war with itself.
Nobody's going to remember how long it took. They're only going to look and see that it was done.
There is one apartment that remains in that building free.
My wife and I met as activists. We have a child. We want to teach that child to stand up for one's principles. We're proud of what we've done. We're proud of the six-year-long fight that this community has waged against this awful project.
All right, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome the program Suki Holly. She is the director, producer, and editor of the documentary film Battle for Brooklyn. Welcome to the program, Suki.
Hi, thanks for having me.
An amazing film. Really enjoyed it both on a number of levels. It's a the filmmaking is excellent, and the story is both great from a sort of a political perspective, but also as a very sort of a deeply personal perspective, or I should say, on an individual level. There's a great story of some of the activists who have been involved in this. But take us back to the beginnings of this. This takes place in the Atlantic Yards of Brooklyn. Set the scene for those people who may not have heard any of this story.
Sure, yes. It began in December of 2003 when, and the film actually took place when they announced this project was going to take, you know, come to the neighborhood. And we were reading about it in the New York Times, and it just read like a press release from the developer. We were very confused. I think they even quoted Frank Gehry as saying he was going to build a neighborhood from scratch. We were confused because we knew that area and we knew that there was a neighborhood there already. And it just raised a lot of questions. So I think it was the next day that we saw a flyer saying stop the project. And we called the number on that flyer and were connected immediately with Patty Hagen, who started the fight against this project. And she just started spewing these details that made a lot of sense. And we said, hold on, we're going to come over and shoot with you. And we followed her around the project. She was saying, you know, there's a massive land grab. They're attempting a massive land grab in the name of sports. And we said, and she also mentioned, you know, Dan Goldstein. He just moved to the neighborhood. You should meet him. I think he's a fighter. I think he's going to fight. And she was right.
And so, you know, the amazing thing about this, and of course, this is the story of this big developer, Ratner, coming in, wanting to move the Nets from New Jersey, build a stadium in Brooklyn, build an entire sort of like quasi-mall, quasi-residential adjunct to this stadium.
Okay.
And the amazing thing that that strikes you is that there is no... It starts there. In other words, there's no sort of like stories of like, wow, this has been a blighted area for 15, 20 years, and people have been talking about what are we going to do with this area. There was really none of that. It just was a guy wanted to build something, and so he found some not empty land necessarily to build it on.
Right. Well, there actually are three blocks of rail yards, open rail yards there, and I think they used that as the pretext for, you know, there not being a neighborhood there. But, of course, the adjacent blocks were filled with people with living there, businesses. In fact, three different condo buildings had just come up from built out of empty warehouses. They were repurposing this neighborhood. It was on its way up. It was developing organically. Of course, it made it very valuable. It's right in the heart of Brooklyn. And not to mention that it's across the street from another Ratner project, Ratner being the developer, so that he, when you put this land all together, it's a huge swath of the middle of Brooklyn, which is becoming very valuable.
Yeah, that was the other thing that was amazing about it. And you mentioned Dan Goldstein, who you follow throughout throughout the film. He's living in like a nice apartment building.
That's right.
And so it was clear that to the extent that there was any development going on, this was not a blighted neighborhood, at least at the beginning of the film. Explain that aspect of it. It needed to become blighted, didn't it?
Yes, it did. In fact, that's under New York State law, in order to use eminent domain, an area has to be declared blighted and in need of urban renewal. And so blight, it has to have one of six characteristics of blight, and that can be cracks in the sidewalk, it can be graffiti, it can be weeds in front of a house. So these things are pretty basic to New York City living. And so in this case, they didn't find blight until 2 years into this project when the lawyers were telling the developer, you know, you need to find blight in order to use this eminent domain, which he needed in order to assemble so many different properties quickly and at a low expense to him.
And so in some ways, they sort of created some blight, didn't they? They started to take down some buildings that they had access to, because what happens on fairly early in the movie is that all of the people living in this rehabbed condo, I guess it's a condo building, the Daniel Goldstein's?
That's right. It's a former warehouse, which was described three of the buildings that were rehabbed into condos, yes.
And everybody in the building has been bought out for some number of money, maybe $1 million, maybe a little bit less. Like 130 of his neighbors are just gone one day, and he's alone in the building.
That's right, yes. Yes, and he's in shock at that moment, too. He couldn't believe, because he'd been lobbying, you know, trying to talk to these people. They all seemed like they were on his side, and yet, at one point, in one fell swoop, everybody sells out. And I think it speaks to the level of power that it was perceived that Ratner had. He's friends with the governor. He's friends with the mayor. They were both supporting this project. And it just felt like something that you had to shrug your shoulders and move on from. And, you know, that was possible for his neighbors. Of course, there were many long-term residents who'd been there for many years, didn't have the resources that these other people did, and they didn't have anywhere to go. They actually stayed and fought as well with Dan.
And then another interesting element of the film, and this is, you know, at one point there was a quality about the film that reminded me of, I think it was like maybe the third or fourth season of The Wire, where
oh, yeah.
you just see sort of the incredible corruption that takes place in these type of instances, where there, it's quite clear that a neighborhood organization that sort of developed overnight in some respects is getting bought off by Ratner. Explain this.
Yes, Build. You're speaking about Build, the group that was that actually formed after the project was announced, and they were supposed to be helping the neighborhood residents, local residents, find jobs, a job, you know, finding group. And this group signed a community benefits agreement with the developer, which actually helped seal a lot of public support for the project because it seemed like something that was really going to benefit the community. However, it turns out late into this film that through a Freedom of Information request, that Build's IRS statements show that Ratner is the sole funder of their organization. So a group that was, you know, started after the project was announced is getting all their money from Ratner, and it brings into question how can they actually fully, you know, negotiate with Ratner on the behalf of the community if they are getting their money from him.
Yeah, I think that's a generous assessment, actually, to say brings into question. I mean, it's amazing. A guy comes in, he starts to buy off the neighborhood. He essentially, from the ground floor, builds a so-called community organization that is then ostensibly tasked with negotiating with him.
Right.
To make sure that the community gets the benefit of what's going on. And it's essentially an appendage of him.
Exactly. And of course, you know, they 2 weeks ago, Build was sued by several of the community members who were promised jobs. They were promised union cards, and they never got them. And that leads us to, you know, the promised jobs that were, you know, the benefit that was, you know, allowed this eminent domain abuse to happen, which they were promising 15,000 jobs through this project. And actually, as of June, there were 350 jobs, and 19 of those jobs went to people in the community.
Well,
so 19 is a far cry from 15,000.
Yes. I can't do the math, but I know that it's less than 14,000, more than 14,000 less than promised.
Exactly.
Well, you also just, spoiler alert, I mean, for people who are out of this project, the film, I guess, goes over almost a 5-6, I guess, an 8-year period or so.
That's right. Yep.
A 7-8-year period. And the project is continuing on. It is but a shell of what it was at the beginning, because Ratner has since sold the Nets and is now leasing the area to the Nets. They're not sure if they're going to go ahead with all the ancillary buildings. Ratner's company lost a lot of value in 2008, and the MTA kept basically, I mean, what's really amazing is that we have an MTA that is supposedly hurting for money, and it couldn't have sold this property for less to Ratner, it seems.
That's right. In fact, there was a higher bid on the table at the time that they approved the Ratner takeover of that rail yard portion. And you have to remember that the MTA board members are appointed by the governor, and the governor is friends with Ratner. And so basically what the governor wants, these appointees will do. And it just became clear at that moment when they took the Ratner bid, which was lower than a competing offer, the competing offer was actually going to take over less space and was much more amenable to the community. They took the lower bid of Ratner's, and basically at any cost. And and that was the idea, was that, you know, the people in power and the people who have money are friends with the people in government, and they get what they want.
You know, this is an amazingly timely story, and I just want to turn slightly to the sort of the story of Daniel, and he goes through almost like a transformation here. He actually, we see that his activism, at the very least, maybe doesn't cause the end of one relationship, but it certainly exposes, I guess, the deficiencies in that relationship.
Definitely.
And we see him develop another relationship that turns into a marriage, into a family with another activist. Just tell me what you saw. I mean, what it was that made Daniel, of his 130 neighbors in that one building, decide, I'm just not going to put up with this.
You know, it's interesting. Patty saw it too. She said he's a fighter. I think he'll fight. I don't know. He just was very principled from the beginning. He found strengths that he didn't know he had, and I think that made him feel very empowered in order to fight for something that he really believed in and he thought was right. And so, in a sense, you know, we show the ups and downs. There are downs. It's very difficult for him. But I think in the end, it's a very uplifting story of someone who finds strengths he didn't know he had. He finds, as you said, a fellow activist. They get married. They have a baby. And he can sleep at night, which is more than, you know, you can say for many of the other characters in the film.
You know, it's interesting, too, because I think that, you know, he strikes me as a guy who comes from a not necessarily, you know, like an upper middle class background. He clearly has some means because it's, you know, it's a nice apartment that he's living in.
Right.
And in some ways, I think there was this element of he was sort of shocked that something like this could happen, which I think happens to people who sort of don't see this type of injustice that happens all the time. And I think in some ways it mirrors what's going on in this country right now, particularly with like the Occupy Wall Street movement.
Right. Yes. And in fact, he basically, that's the story of this film, is that the rich, powerful, connected guy gets help from his friends in government at the expense of the rest of us. And yes, I think it was definitely something that the creep was creeping close, you know, further and further into the middle class. And he said, you know, this is not right. It's never been right. And I'm not going to stand by and enable this process to go forward.
Do you think that if this whole story had taken place now, I'm looking at different moments over the course of the 7-8 years that are covered by the film. And it is a really up and down type of struggle. There are court cases, there are direct actions, there are protests. But I couldn't help but wonder that if this took place 4 or 5 years later, if there wouldn't be a different context in which this was happening, and there wouldn't be more resources to draw upon.
Yes, definitely. And I think this speaks to the media element of this fight. The media it's just so interesting because most of my neighbors in Brooklyn have no idea what happened over those past 8 years. They just sort of heard little bits about this Atlantic Yards coming, and then you heard one line from the crank at the end of the piece, and, you know, that was it. It was a he said, she said kind of thing. It was never gone into in any detail about the merits. And so also it was like who the press decided to focus on and pay attention to. It was always developer-driven stories that benefited somehow the PR for the developer. And that was actually what prompted us to keep going with this over so many years, was that it was so clear that the developer was controlling the narrative. He spent $1 million a year at least on PR. Dan was painted as a crank who just didn't want to move. And we knew the story was so different, and we were very, very committed to getting out, you know, to changing the narrative on this story.
And I should also add, too, that this is being subsidized by the taxpayer.
That's right.
Not the film, but the project.
That's right. Not the film.
So tell me, what is the status of the film now? Where can people see it? How can people check it out?
We are setting up many different screenings here and there. We have one on the 13th here in New York at Stranger Than Fiction. There are a couple that we're talking to the Lemley Theaters about setting up in January, at the very beginning of January. You can find all of that on the battleforbrooklyn.com website, and you'll see when it's coming to your area.
And I've also, frankly, I've seen the film on at least a couple lists for films to watch for the Academy Award. Am I not supposed to say that? I mean, does that jinx it?
I don't know. I haven't been talking
about it. It's a great film, and it works on many different levels. And so I congratulate the work that you did. And it's, like I say, it's a great film on different levels, both on the sort of the narrative level and on the political story. And there was also a quality, I got to tell you this too, that there was – I loved, and I know you did the editing, but I loved how you hung on certain shots. There was just always this quality of maybe that somebody was going to rush in and save the day.
Right.
And I'm not sure quite exactly. I got to watch it again to see how you created that feeling. Maybe it was just my own sort of hope springs eternal. But there was always this sense of like, oh, they're hanging on this. Somebody's going to come in. There's a phone call coming. And sadly, it never came. But,
well, it's interesting because people who do know the outcome, people from Brooklyn, say they were on the edge of their seats when they watch it because it just seemed like it wasn't possible that the outcome was what it was.
It's true.
So,
well,
yeah.
I congratulate you. The film is Battle for Brooklyn. The website is battleforbrooklyn.com.
That's right.
And we will link to it on our site at majority.fm. We got to take a break. Suki Hawley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we've got plenty of stories to discuss. News to cover. Great film. I really honestly cannot recommend it.
It was really, really, really good. I highly recommend it.
Do you see that? Did Matt just backed me up on that. And he usually doesn't like anything that's not animated.
What?
We gotta take a break. We'll be right back.
Some people say that bowling alley's got big lanes.
Got big lanes. Got big lanes.
Some people say that bowling alleys all look the same.
Look the same. Look the same.
There's not a line that goes here that rhymes with anything. Last night, but I forget what it was.
What it was, what it was.
Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling.
We are back, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report, and today's like a day of outrage, or I should say yesterday. So the Plan B, or the day after pill, that sometimes people refer to it. It essentially is birth control. It's essentially a birth control pill, but a higher dosage. So if you are a woman, you take it within, I think, like 24 to 36 hours of unprotected sex, it can prevent a fertilized egg from embedding in the uterus, which I believe is essentially how the birth control pill works, but it does it prior to that. And it has been a drug that has been studied probably significantly more than most drugs that get released by the FDA, because it's been around for over a decade, and it's been in Europe for more than that. But you know, the fundamentalists don't like it because, well, if you're a woman and you have sex, you should be punished. One of the ways that they believe in punishing you is having to have a forced pregnancy. And it has been going through all sorts of different studies by the Federal Drug Administration. And the head of the FDA, Margaret Hamburg, was prepared to announce that the drug could now be sold over the counter. Understand that Tylenol, acetaminophen, is a far more dangerous drug. People have overdosed on acetaminophen. People have used it to commit suicide. You need to take a lot of it. But it is an extremely dangerous drug if it is abused. Not so with the Plan B drug. Acetaminophen is sold over the counter. No matter what your age is, you can walk into a pharmacy, a Duane Reade, whatever it is, and buy it. So the FDA was prepared by their own press release. I will quote, I agree. This is speaking to, this is Margaret Hamburg's statement. There is adequate and reasonable, well-supported, and science-based evidence that Plan B, one step, that's the name of the drug, is safe and effective and should be approved for non-prescription use for all females of childbearing potential. But in her statement, she writes, however, this morning I received a memorandum, this is yesterday, from the Secretary of Health and Human Services, this being Kathleen Sebelius, invoking her authority under Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act to execute its provisions and stating that she does not agree with the agency's decision to allow the marketing of Plan B one-step non-prescription for all females of childbearing potential. This is an unprecedented move by the head of the FDA to deny women access to this drug over the counter. Ostensibly because Kathleen Sebelius says that women, children, ages 12 to 17, do not have the capacity to read the label properly and take the drug safely. However, there were multiple studies, one involving 335 girls, ages 12 to 17, that showed between 72 and 96% of them understood the proposed package label well enough to use the drug safely and effectively on their own. A second study involving 300 girls, 11 to 16, showed that they could use the product properly and safely. In fact, there was study after study that showed girls, women of that age, to have, despite what Sebelius cited, the cognitive development to take the drug properly. Now, if this is the standard, how is it that we're selling acetaminophen? How is it that we're selling a myriad of other drugs over the counter, which have the potential to be far more dangerous? So the effect of this drug, of this ruling by the FDA, make no mistake about it, is it will increase the number of unwanted pregnancies. It will increase the number of abortions. And it denies women, young women, if you want to call them children, in some instances, 11, 12, 13-year-olds, any type of sovereignty over their own body. There is no data that shows that anyone is more likely to engage in unprotected sex with the knowledge that these pills exist. And there's no data to suggest that these people cannot take the pills safely. So this is just a craven, cynical political move on the eve of an election year by the Obama administration, and it's a real shame. A real shame. I don't know what else to say about it, folks.
I wonder if this affects in any way Planned Parenthood, because I'm pretty sure they provide Plan B for free.
Well, I don't think it's it doesn't affect them because this is the same rules they've been operating under. But understand that contraception is already available to children, to women under the age of 17. You can buy spermicidal jelly. You can buy condoms. I think you can buy I don't even remember what the name of them are now. Been so long. Been so long.
Not that, just that I engage in sex, frankly. Never mind worried about protection. I'm married, so. I think married people will understand what I'm talking about. It's really upsetting. And it just goes to show you that, you know, women's rights really at the back of the bus. Really at the back of the bus. Let's go to the better half of the program. I'm under no obligation to give a full 40 minutes, particularly when I get emails saying, like, yeah, 40 minutes is not for me. That's why I'm not going to join. Really? I'm still stuck in my craw.
Maybe Freebie should get a punishment for that email and just get 30 minutes now. And every time we get an email like that, we just lower the amount of time in the free
by
show.
By
5 minutes.
Maybe. Folks, Friday morning, the new website. Oh, and you know, those young whippersnappers at
Citizen Radio?
Citizen Radio. They don't give out. Do they give out? What do? Is their whole thing free? What do?
I'm pretty sure their whole thing is free, but they have, like, bonus material for members.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know if they give out swag like we do.
They have almost 100 more donate your accounters than we do. Folks, you can go to the site, donate your account. Donate your Facebook account. Donate your Twitter account. If you don't have one, start one. And donate it. Gets the word out. Also, more importantly, become a member. If everybody who listened to the free podcast became a member, I would never say the words donate your account again. I only say that because I know it won't happen. I mean, it would be thousands of members.
If everyone
thousands upon thousands of members. We wouldn't be able to handle it, frankly.
If everyone who listens to the show is a member, well, you wouldn't have to plead for members.
Yeah. We could stop these pleas right now by all of you becoming members.
Yeah.
But if you want to buy some coffee, tea, or chocolate, fair trade, we're going to have one of those guys on to talk about this because fair trade's been in the news lately. JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get a 10% discount. If you are buying junk through Amazon, buy it through our link. Find the link on our homepage at majority.fm on the right-hand side. Click it, bookmark it, buy all your junk through there. You won't see any difference, except for you'll just notice a little bit more optimism in my voice. Join us in the after show. Oh, I got an email from Andrew Schiff. I'll read that in the after show. Number 646-257-3920. You can also IM us at Majority FM. We'll see you there.